Welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast, where we amplify the stories of regular people practicing anti-racism in their everyday lives. Every single one of us has the ability to create real and meaningful change right where we are. I'm your host, Carrie Sawyer, and I've got the stories to prove it. I can't wait to introduce you to these people, these change leaders, people who saw a need and decided to take action. To me, this is so inspiring, showing the powerful idea of everyday activism. I hope that you take away at least some small inspiration and use it to act and create more good in your world too. Let's get started, y'all. Hello, hello, and welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast. My name is Carrie Sawyer, and I will be your host for today's episode. We are super excited. I am super excited to talk to one of my friends, a fellow DEI practitioner, and just really a good human being and an amazing soul on this planet. Her name is Michelle Antoine, and I'm excited to introduce her and then jump right into the conversation that we're going to have today. So, RM Michelle Antoine is a facilitator and creative working to take the training wheels off talk. As the creator and founder of Curios, Michelle curates experiences that foster curiosity, bravery, and intentionality through leadership, communication, consulting, workshops, and trainings, and also retreats. Michelle is one of my favorite people that I've met here doing this work. Because she's just so authentic that she inspires more authenticity out of everyone around her. And when she asks you, "Hey, Carrie, how are you doing?" she like really means it. She really wants to know. And I love that about her. Please join me in welcoming to today's episode, Michelle Antoine. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast. We are so happy to have you here today. How are you?
I'm doing so well, Carrie. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yay. So, Michelle, go ahead and introduce yourself. Let our listeners know a little bit about you, and then we will jump right into the questions.
Yeah, sure. My name is Michelle Antoine. I use she, her pronouns. I'm based in San Diego, California, and right now, I guess I'd say that my work is centered around being a consultant. I would say a change consultant first and foremost, but what that means to me is helping people have challenging conversations, particularly around giving them tools and practice to be able to engage in communication that's a bit more mindful, that's a bit more holistic. And that speaks a bit more to the heart of the matter. I think in the workplaces that we see today, and especially as workplaces, I think are starting to sense that their workers have a lot more agency, especially post-COVID. Mm-hmm. I'm just really in a space of, you know, developing leaders and individuals in having conversations that might be challenging to have, but that are necessary if they want to be able to kind of move towards the future of work that we're all kind of, you know, inching toward. So that's a little bit about what I'm doing now. And I do that through my consultancy, Curios. And yeah, that's a little bit about me. I'm sure more will come out as we.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. I really love the work that you do. And I think that it's so important, this idea of learning how to have uncomfortable and or difficult conversations, especially as we start to navigate these spaces, I think differently. We've been talking about a lot of these things around the isms, around racism, around anti-racism for a really long time, but more people are engaging in the conversations. They're happening more readily in the workplace than they were versus it being a topic of like, don't talk about religion, politics, or race. Like now we're talking about, now we're taking race off of that no-go, no-fly zone plate. And so naturally there's going to be a lot of discomfort in people talking about it, because even though people who have been talking about this for a long time, we're used to talking to each other And now we're getting to talk to more people, and more people are wanting to jump in. And so there's this tension, this friction that is created. And so actually learning how to cultivate the skills to have those conversations, to lean into and expect the discomfort versus like running away or taking that as a sign, oh, we should stop.
Right.
I think is it's so important too. So I admire you and I admire the work that you're doing and see its place so just really so important in everything that's happening now and in how we're moving things forward. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so the first question that I like to ask people is around activism. And so, Michelle, tell me, what does it mean to you to be an activist in 2022? And do you consider yourself to be one?
Such a loaded question. I'm going to start with the second one and say that no, I don't title or name myself as an activist, because I do think that there is such a responsibility and such a particular kind of mindset, I think that, and a particular place that people's minds go when you think about an activist. Mm-hmm. And I want to always make sure that I'm being truthful about the kind of work that I do and the kind of space that I take and how I move around the world. And I think that activists have a very important role in the quest for, you know, equity, diversity, inclusion, belonging. And I think that it's important that they're upheld. And I think it's important that they're distinguished from, I think, the other work that other people are doing, like myself. So I would say no, I don't think I consider myself an activist, but I would say, and I think your first question was around like how or like,
yeah, what does it mean to
yeah,
you?
Yeah, what does it mean? I think that there are different ways to activate. And I think that how I activate is by the way I move on a daily basis, the way I open my mind to different perspectives and different ways of being and knowing, the way I help individuals and teams and, you know, organizations to open their minds to different ways of being and knowing and doing. And I think that that is certainly an activation, but I don't think that that makes me an activist, because I think when I think of activists, and again, I don't know what you think of when you think of activists. I'd love to hear. But I think of someone who's on the street, who's putting like foot to pavement, who is kind of the front line when there are protests, who is particularly activating in terms of being kind of mobilizing laws and governments. Like, that's what I think of when I think of an activist. And I don't think, you know, again, I think all of our roles are important in various ways, and we all have a role to play, but I don't think that that one is mine.
Sure. No, absolutely. And yeah, I think one of the things I admire most about Michelle is that she's so thoughtful and so intentional. I just love the way that she expresses herself and how her mind works. And it totally makes sense what you said based on the work that you do and the person that I know. And your intentionality. And yeah, I definitely have the same kind of like activist is like kind of a trigger word a little bit and creates a very strong image. And what I've been thinking about and trying to expand myself on is like, okay, what if activism is like a spectrum? And there's like a spectrum that is that person on the street, but then there's that person who's sitting in their desk at work, and there are things and ways that they can activate themselves and others around issues that matter to them. And they might not, it's not a full-time thing. It's like a jump in, jump out kind of thing. But still thinking about like, what does that mean to activate? And even thinking about activism as just the word activate, like who am I trying to activate? And like, what am I trying to activate them towards? I really love that. I'm going to borrow that as I continue to expand what my definition of activism is and, you know, how we encourage people in activating around a topic. And there's so many places and spaces and opportunities. And, you know, it's my belief that we all have I mean, really several, but at least one space where we can activate mm-hmm. ourselves and others towards creating change and creating more good around us.
1,000%. And I think that that nuance is obviously more for the broader audience that I think we're speaking to rather than you and I. Because I think, you know, I think if I was speaking just like a smaller group of folks, like, are we all activists and can we all be activists in our own way, in our own circles, in our own environments? Of course. Like, I think that that's definitely true. But when I think of, you know, like language and, you know, words matter. And I think that when someone names themselves an activist, I think that right now, the kind of the broad understanding of that word, I think, is very specific. It should yeah. be a bit more nuanced, I think. But yeah. I think that based on that broad definition that maybe doesn't take into account the spectrum, you know, no, I don't think that I would be considered an activist, but I certainly am an activator. And I think you are too. And we all can be.
Absolutely. So Michelle, as you were talking, I actually was curious, and this is when you were giving your introduction, how did you get into this work? Like, where did it start for you, and how did it grow into Curios and and the work that you do around supporting organizations and people and having these difficult conversations about really important topics?
Yeah, well, I think I've always, you know, and hindsight's 2020, right? Like, you always kind of see the through line, like, after the fact of maybe how you got to a place or kind of the dots that connect. But I spent, you know, around 10 years in higher education and student affairs. And I've always had a passion for education and for educating the next generation and for supporting them through kind of the growing pains that come with kind of like becoming an adult and an adult in this like weird ass world that we live in. And and in student affairs and higher ed, I was often tasked with putting together trainings and workshops for students, for graduate staff, for professional staff around conflict resolution, around diversity, equity, and inclusion, and what that meant for the communities that we were looking to build on campus. And I think that the roots of kind of what I do now definitely were planted in higher ed and student affairs for sure. I think that there was always a sense in me when I started to work professionally that in professional environments, you're not always saying the thing you need to say, and you're not always hearing the truth. And it always felt like there, you know, and we hear about these things all the time in corporate spaces and really any space that you're working with people, you know, the meeting after the meeting, or, you know, right. The politics. And, you know, I've never been good at that. I've never been good at kind of playing the game and, you know, understanding where I could and couldn't say the thing, because to me, the truth is what we should be speaking most of the time. And I get that there's a way to do it. And I still think that that's true. But I think if we're deviating from the truth in any way, it does feel like it's not supportive of the environments that we want to create in the workplace. So, you know, even in higher ed and student affairs, it always felt to me like there was always kind of a barrier to how authentic or transparent people could be. And that made me really uncomfortable. And I didn't like it. And it made me feel icky. And it made me feel like I couldn't fully express myself. So I transitioned outside. And I tried really hard within my scope of influence. And that was, you know, one of my mentors, like, words of wisdom to me when I was kind of struggling with some of these things internally. He would tell me, like, you know, you have a scope of influence. Like, you can influence like this group of people or this community that you're tasked with like leading. So focus on that. Like, sometimes you can't necessarily impact the larger culture of a place that you're in, but if you're leading a group, you can influence that, and you can influence how transparent you are with them so that they can take maybe some of the things that you're modeling with them in their leadership. So sure. So I think, you know, that was a part of how I got started internally in that work. And it was always kind of back of my mind, like, like that seems weird that I can't, you know, say the thing here, or I have to kind of bite my tongue, or et cetera. I've always been told that I was really good at, or I asked really good questions. So I'll circle back to that in terms of the name for Curios, but I've always been a really curious person, asking, wanting to know the context of any situation I'm in, I think, you know, is a really good place to start to be able to answer questions that, you know, in a way that's, that makes sense and is holistic and kind of takes into consideration a lot of different perspectives. And then when I worked for Tony Robbins, after working in higher ed for so long, I learned a ton about starting a business and creating content, and that some of the ickiness that I felt in higher ed and student affairs was also present there. So it didn't feel like it was an isolated, you know, I thought like, oh my gosh, like maybe I'll transition and it'll be something else. It isn't. It's everywhere. And so long-windedly, I guess, the work started in student affairs and higher ed, and it started with an inkling within myself. Like, why is it that in workplaces and in work environments, we can't, it felt like we couldn't show up in the wholeness of ourselves. And I think that that's where the work of Curios has and is growing now. For me, it's kind of about walking into spaces and helping people with the self-awareness, the mindfulness, listening skills, the, you know, effective feedback giving and receiving skills to be able to really engage interpersonally in a way that really takes into account the entirety of a person, so that we're not so fragmented in the workplace, which is what it felt like when I couldn't say the thing. So that was a long answer, but that's a little bit of how I got to the work now.
No, I love it. And I love that it's really all rooted in what I'm hearing is like a value of like truth and being able to speak the truth at the time that the truth needs to come out, even if it's difficult or uncomfortable or awkward or just, and the thing is like when you're speaking the truth, I'm not even sure that it always feels that way to the speaker, right? It kind of feels like a natural thing to say. And I think, I mean, again, it's so important. It comes up over and over again in the work that I do. Today I had a presentation where one of the findings of a research study they were doing was really that there's too many white people on your board. And like, that's super common, right? Super common. You're not unusual, a problem that a lot of people are struggling with. But like, how do you say that to a group of white people that there's too many of you on the board? And I want to say it in a sensitive way. And I actually, even me thinking about doing this work all the time, okay, this could feel uncomfortable for the people I'm going to say this to. And how can I say that in a more sensitive way? And I kind of caveated it in like the truth and that this is the work that we're doing. Like part of the work is to say the thing that needs to be said. And so this is what I'm going to share next, something that needs to be said. And even if it feels uncomfortable, because we need to acknowledge it so we can move forward through it. And that was kind of like, you know, my preamble to then tell all the white people that there's too many, specifically white males in this case. And so even as a practitioner having a difficult conversation, I also coached someone recently, a different client. She is also a white lady. And she was like, how do I talk about the bias that I've read about to other people, mostly not people of color? But there could still be people of color in the room and like not represent myself as an expert, not step on toes, not offend anyone, but still talk about these things that are important. And I was like, ooh, this is a really good question. And so we got to unpack the difficult conversations that she was having and how she can acknowledge kind of her place and not knowing everything and not being the expert. And maybe she might misstep, but creating space for people to come in and talk later and help to call her in when she needs to be called in. And so, you know, it's something that we're navigating all the time. And what I really love about her example, especially, is that she was stepping up to have these conversations, even though she knew that she might be perceived in a way that she didn't want to, that her intent and impact might not match up. But she was like, you know, how do I do this anyways? Because it's important. And this is the work that we're doing.
I love that. And I love it when white people specifically are, because I think, you know, marginalized communities and marginalized people and BIPOC and folks who have not or who have less privilege than, you know, others
I think often are tasked with the burden of discomfort. Mm-hmm. Like we're always uncomfortable, but it's kind of a given and it's almost like a default. So I love that this woman was kind of came into that situation knowing like this is going to be uncomfortable for me, but I know that it's part of the, because it is. And it goes back to what you told, you know, that group of that board about having too many, you know, or having not enough, you know, others on their board. Like it really is essential for people to be able to lean into the discomfort of the work. Like if you can't do that, you can't do the work. Like it's not possible, or at least you won't be doing it in a way that's rooted in truth. So that's pretty powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've said this before, I really feel like between the pandemic, between what happened in the summer of 2020 with George Floyd and then the subsequent hate crimes against Asians, like it's really like taken the lid off and the filter off. And we're able to say things to different groups in different ways that we weren't able to say before, and carrying that burden of both discomfort and silence in an aspect. But now, you know, I'm like, hey, I'm in this majority white group. I'm like, I'm going to say white. I'm going to say white people. I'm going to say Black people. These are things that we can get used to feeling that discomfort. And then hopefully as we lean into that, it starts to go away. And I had to coach someone recently also. I'm like, you know, one of the reasons why people are so uncomfortable because they think that mentioning race is racist. If you acknowledge a race, then that is racist. And this fundamental misunderstanding of what racism is and what it looks like and how it manifests. And so if I say Michelle's Black in a neutral way, that's not racist. It's just a fact. Now I can be like, oh, she was Black. Totally different thing. So I get how there can be confusion. But this idea that just acknowledging so that we can then problem solve, like move forward, create space, whatever those things are, it's necessary. And so getting past that, it's okay to talk about it. It's okay to talk about the elephant in the room. It really isn't an elephant for most of us. It's just a reality.
People are often looking to kind of like for a black and white answer or like a list of five things you can and cannot say for black. But that's not how life works, really. And again, I think that, you know, having a problem with listing someone's physical attributes, and again, like you said, I think there's nuance to it. There are ways where, of course, it could be problematic and offensive. And there are ways in which someone's identity very much should be a part of the conversation. And it does impact the, you know, it does impact and influence the outcome of certain situations or conversations. So we have to be able to get comfortable in naming the thing. And what's interesting to me about like people finding, you know, still, you know, in 2022, or being uncomfortable with people with naming someone's race or stating it as being racist, it feels like racist not to. Like, why wouldn't you acknowledge someone's difference? Like the difference itself, not naming the difference makes it feel like there's something wrong with the difference also. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a perspective to consider. Like, why does it make anyone uncomfortable to name the difference? And the difference is in comparison to whiteness, right? I mean, that's usually what the difference is. So it really is like a weird kind of, and again, I do get it. Like you said, I understand in some respects, but it also feels like at the place that we're at today, where we're at with race and identity and sexuality, et cetera, today, like we need to be able to move to beyond the difference is scary and bad to the place difference is to be celebrated and acknowledged and understood, so that we can get, so that we can evolve, honestly, because whiteness is not the default. We've always known that, but it's now we're talking about it a lot more explicitly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So Michelle, in your work, in your experience, like, can you give an example of like, what's like the most difficult kind of conversation that you have gotten to kind of coach people through navigating? Like, what does that look like?
Well, I think that because my background is, like my educational background, like my practical background is in communication, I think that the most challenging thing that I often have to coach people through is how to navigate giving people news, information, feedback, like just any piece of information that is not going to be potentially like positive, quote unquote, right? And like by positive, I mean like it might not feel good. It might be about someone's performance. It might be about someone's race or about maybe not about someone's race, but about maybe a lack of diversity. It might be about just something that's, it will make someone shift in their seat, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that what it looks like is for me, because I approach this work really, and it's been kind of like an internal and an external like journey for me, from a place of like self-awareness. I think you have to really come into conversation with the level of understanding of where your own biases might be and might land. That takes a lot of internal processing. It takes a lot of practice to be able to even like note for yourself when those things come up. It comes with also a lot of, I think it also comes with a lot of deprogramming. Mm. We have to really get to, like, I think what I try to do is help people to, we all have a default in terms of how we listen, how we engage, kind of where our brains go. And for me, you know, and I think I've told you this, for example, I took a yoga certification. I'm a certified yoga teacher as well. And for me, this work is like holistic in nature. And I don't think it's an accident that these things happen like simultaneously for me. Like to be able to pause and reflect is not something that we're taught often. Like in our society, it's very much like react. How quickly can you answer the question? How quickly can you move to the next thing, et cetera? And for me, teaching people how to be able to pause and really have take a second for themselves prior to reacting. And some of my colleagues and I, shout out to Jen Nguyen and Gabe Wilson for kind of putting these words together for me, because I think the frame was in my brain, but the shift, right? The mindset shift here is like from a place of reactivity to a place of like choicefulness. Like what choice are you going to make? Mm-hmm. What choices are available to you after you've paused and reflected in the moment when you're in a moment of interaction, in a moment of trigger, in a moment of challenge? So I think that skill set, it sounds simple, right? Like I say it out loud and it sounds like, oh, okay, yeah, like I just have to practice but it's hard. It's hard to move from a place, particularly when you're dealing with certain dynamics. Like if you're talking about family dynamics, if you're talking about dynamics in which you already have like a conflict with someone in the workplace, if you're talking about a racial dynamic, like these things are challenging to move through because again, we have a default. So for me, the skill set is really around teaching folks how to practice that, that pause and reflect and then choosing to act differently than what you typically might do. So I don't know if I'm answering the question, but it's an internal process that I'm helping people work through. And again, a lot of people want like a checklist, right? Like here are the 5 or 10 things you can do to have a productive feedback conversation. Don't get me wrong. I think there's certainly like best practices and et cetera that can be taught. And those are easily implemented in terms of a process or whatever. But in the moment when you're in conversation and you're the, you know, employee or you're in the employer and your employee is coming to you with some feedback, for example, there are power dynamics at play. There are potentially racial dynamics at play. There are a lot of different things you have to take into consideration. And then again, being able to like in the moment, use some tools and activate some of your, or deactivate, honestly, deactivate some of your kind of default mechanisms. Yeah. Like that's hard. It's hard work and it's a practice. It's not something that you do overnight. So that's what I hope to challenge people to do.
I love that word, choicefulness. It's so good and it makes you think. And the idea of there is a choice and there's a process to creating space to make that choice, like, right? Because obviously mindfulness, a play on that, mm-hmm. But mindfulness mm-hmm. is something that's simple but not easy, mm-hmm. right? And so choicefulness is something that is simple and not easy. And especially like when you're in those moments, there's sometimes where you're like, oh, I can pause, this is easy. And there's other times like like the example you give around family dynamics, like just think how fast there's a family member that can trigger you in
.00001 seconds.
And before you know it, you've been like fuming either internally or externally. And it's been like 2 minutes before you can even realize that you're in that triggered state, yes, right?
1,000%. And all of us have that, you know, like I think a lot of people will go to, you know, and this is probably why I only have the amount of clients that I have at a time. I'm like really honest about the fact that like I may be in this work and I think that there's so much wisdom in the room when I'm working with people. I think that there's so much more that people know about themselves and about how mm-hmm. to navigate a particular situation. I might be in this work, but I do not have all the answers. I obviously often mess up and have to practice this as well. But I think that the difference is I've been reading and immersed and kind of educating both myself and others about this for so long that sure, it might come a little bit more easily to me intellectually to be able to move through this, but it's not something that anyone is particularly good at, I'd say. I think that it's something that all of us, because it's just ingrained in the way our society currently operates, have to practice to be able to get to the other side.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Like interrupting those behaviors that we're just so used to doing and then replacing it with something else and knowing mm-hmm. what the right thing to replace it with is. Because it's one thing to like catch yourself, to pause. Okay, but now what do I do?
Exactly.
I pause and now I'm going to just continue down that line because I'm not sure what to replace with. And I think that's where a lot of the power from your work really comes is that kind of that second step, if you will.
And can I name a few things?
Please.
Just because I think I want to say just a few things. People are like, well, yeah, that's true. Like, what do I do if I like realize that I'm like in a moment and I'm activated and I'm mad or, you know, whatever, and I kind of just want to react? Like, I think that there are so many options available to us that we don't think about. It's very, very, I would honestly be so, it's frustrating in the moment, but it also just feels so good. My partner, for example, is getting better at this, at asking me for a second to process prior to continuing a conversation. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in the moment, that's hard. So if you're in a workplace setting and you're receiving some feedback that's hard to hear, it's very okay not to have a response right away and say like, thank you for the feedback. Can I have a day or two to process this? And can we revisit this conversation? That's one. You can also say, I actually need a second right this moment. Like I need to leave the room and just kind of like walk around for a bit because I feel my body getting hot and I'm a bit uncomfortable. Like that's also very much okay. Like leaving is not leaving the situation with the intent to return, right? Like not just like running away,
right.
But leaving with the intent to return is very much an option. I think asking questions is also a really good way to like to separate and put some space between what you might be receiving and how you want to react, because often again we kind of jump to this place of like I want to answer and like not seem dumb or not seem like I don't know what to say, and it's okay to just ask clarifying questions. So you can leave, you can ask clarifying questions, you can like, there are just, I guess I just implore people to really think about what else they can do. I just gave two options, but there are so many other things that people really can choose to do in moments where they would typically have kind of a canned response, right? And I just think it's important to like think about those for yourself before kind of going into any conversation where you think things might get heated or uncomfortable. Yeah,
I love that. And I think that we often do forget that we don't have to react right now. We don't have to have the perfect answer or even know what our answer is at that moment. And that's regardless of whether you're in a, you know, a personal relationship or a professional relationship. Mm-hmm. We always have the opportunity and the availability to exit and then come back and revisit later when we're able to get our thoughts around us, where we can be in a more centered place and we're able to process. I remember my partner was trying to have a super serious conversation when I was like feeling very sick. Mm-hmm. I was starving and we were eating Thai in a restaurant. And I was like, this is not, I didn't say this in my mind. I'm like, this is not the time to have this conversation. Yeah. I just said, I can't have this conversation right now. It's important for us to have it. And I would love to revisit it when, you know, I'm feeling better so I can be in a center place mm-hmm. and we're not like in public.
And I'm not hangry.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not hangry. But even in the workplace, that's still totally fine. And, you know, a lot of times we can give away our power yes. and just assume that we have to do it the way that the other person has put forward. And that's not true. We're always in these moments of co-creation. And if it feels better to you to pause and come back, then that's available to you mm-hmm. no matter what situation you're in.
Yep. And we forget our bodies in the workplace often. So even, mm-hmm. you know, in a personal relationship, for example, it might feel easier to say like, I haven't had lunch and I'm feeling a bit like, have a bit of a headache. I'm a little thirsty right now. Like, I think once I take care of my body, I will feel more equipped to be able to like be present with you. Like mm-hmm. I would love if people in the workplace were able to just be better at saying things like that. Cause how many heated conversations could probably be avoided or like weird, just like scrambly, like quickly written emails could be avoided if you just like took a second, like, actually, I'm going to write this after lunch. Like, it doesn't need to be sent out right now. And I'm not thinking clearly. Like, and again, we forget that we have a body. We forget that we have agency. We forget that, like, you know, we have, we have a choice. We have a choice. And we really forget that, I think. Yeah. And I think it's not only time, but it's overdue, right? That we move to a place that we're able to kind of, and I honestly think even if it wasn't time, I think the way the Great Resignation has happened and, or is happening and the way that people have kind of transformed, I would say maybe post-COVID in terms of like their work and life relationship, I think we're kind of already moving there, whether employers want to hear it or not. I think we're already moving to a place where people are understanding that they have the agency, as they should, to kind of remember, oh, like, I have a body. Oh, I have children. Oh, I have a life. Oh, I have other stressors that could impact how I'm going to be in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And it's essential. It really is. It feels sad that it's taken us this long to get here, but also, I know.
But this is where we are now.
This is where we are.
Yeah, we have agency to ask for accommodations mm-hmm. for the rest of our life, because there's no such thing as work-life balance. Like, this is, everything is, has always, and is especially now, the awareness is much greater that it's all mixed together. Mm-hmm. And how do we manage a world where now it's okay to acknowledge that this is all mixed together and I have needs
yep.
That are outside of a paperclip.
Like, I'm not a robot.
Pile holders.
Right. And,
you know, 15 minute break.
Right. Exactly.
For sure. Michelle, this has been amazing. So I have one last question for you. And I would really love to hear, like, all right, so you're doing this work, you're learning, you're growing as mm-hmm. both an individual and as a professional entrepreneur. Like, what's the one thing that you're wrestling with right now? Like, how are you evolving? And what are the things that are like on your mind to figure out for the next steps for Michelle and for Curios and for your business? I know this is like a super deep question to ask. I don't know. I just wanted to ask it.
It is a super deep layered question. So what they don't tell you about entrepreneurship is that you will need to shed parts of yourself to be successful. Mm-hmm. Like, there are patterns that I have as, like, personal patterns that I have that need to, but also should, likely, from my perspective, evolve if I want my business to be sustainable. I think that how I'm growing into that right now is, oh gosh, there's so many ways. So I don't know that I can answer one, but I'll certainly say kind of what comes, you know, to mind right now. One of the ways is that my worth is not attached, which again, I think is a lot of what's happening with the Great Resignation too. So I'm not exempt, even if I'm not working in a corporate environment. I think often we equate our worth with how much money we're bringing in, with how many clients we have, with how busy we are. and there very much is struggle internally for me to be able to intellectually move beyond that kind of gauge for success. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that I'm kind of, you know, working through. I think that the other thing is that the work I want to do is takes a long time. And I think that I've realized that, you know, I certainly believe that there are foundational steps and things that can be done with organizations and teams and individuals that kind of is a stepping stone towards transformational, you know, transformational shifts in how people interact. But I think right now what I'm kind of moving through is figuring out a way to balance both the long-term transformation that I know is necessary and the short-term, what can people do right now? Because I don't like to go into workplaces and feel like I'm being called upon to fill a checklist or like, oh, like we had a mindful conversation, mindful listening session, and now we're, you know, mindful listeners. Like it feels like a longer, it takes longer than one session to be able to practice and implement that. So those are the two things that come to mind that I'm kind of working through. And I guess what it boils down to is being patient, honestly, with myself and with my work so that I continue to be centered and rooted in the personal shifts that I'm going through, but also intentionally and mindfully implement those and kind of how I want Curios to grow as a company. And I don't know if that made sense to you, but that's what's coming up.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I just want to thank you so much and acknowledge you for sharing that, sharing kind of what's on your mind. And I love just the contrast of like, we talked a lot about work and I was just wondering about the other side of it, like the person who's doing this work and creating this space, like what are you wrestling with? And I mean, I definitely, when I first left corporate and started to figure out how I was going to run my own business, like that idea of productivity, I found myself judging myself based on corporate productivity versus like an entrepreneur's day is its own organic thing. And it's going to look very different depending upon the kind of work you are doing, the kind of person that you are, how you work best, what the flow of your business is, like a million things, right? Like how much laundry is piled up. Like it just totally depends. Right. And so that took a little bit. It took a while for me to realize that that was one of the tensions that I was feeling. And then once I felt that, I'm like, well, what is my best day flow? Like what would I want? Because I left corporate for different reasons. Mm-hmm. One of them was to have more freedom in what my day looks like. And now I'm going to like punish myself for
not having the freedom that you wanted. Oh my gosh. It's such a struggle.
It is. So I think that's a totally normal phase. And I bet it happens at different times too in your business, depending upon the phase. So I definitely get that. And then in the work that we're doing, many people are doing it because we want to change the world for the better. We see the opportunity, we see the possibility, we see the good in people and the ability to evolve and transform. And that does take a long time. And so deciding to take jobs that are little or quick hits versus jobs that are longer, how do you attract those clients who really want to do the transformational work? And once they find out what that actually means, because so many people don't really understand, even if they think they want it, they still want to do it with you. Right? Or they want to do it with someone. So how do you kind of navigate that? And even, you know, this idea of an ideal client and who that ideal client is, like being able to take only your ideal client is a privilege, right? Like at a certain point in your entrepreneurial journey, you're taking a client that comes, unless you're just independently wealthy and doing this thing for fun. So as you evolve and as your business grows, you can be potentially more selective, but still, like, what's the balance of that, of like bills and your ideal client and what you're trying to accomplish and what's coming in the door and how you're changing your messaging? It's this whole complicated, glorious, like ball of yarn. And, you know, that's what you sign up for knowingly and unknowingly as an entrepreneur. Yep. And how do you unravel it in your own unique way? Because there's a million different ways to unravel that. And how do you stay true to yourself in all of this? There's There's so much. And I think that's a whole nother podcast episode.
It really is.
Michelle, thank you so much for this conversation. I love talking with you and I just appreciate you giving us your time and your insight and actual tips from Curious and how you're navigating the different work that you're doing with your clients in different organizations. So I appreciate you so much. If people want to find out like more about your work, where can they find you?
Yeah, sure. So my website would be a good place to start. It's www.curiosbynature.com. And curios is spelled curious without the U, the second U. And that would be one good place to start. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm not as active on social media these days. I don't know about anybody else, but I'm a bit burned. But LinkedIn Instagram are good places to find me as well. And yeah, I think that honestly, the best way is to just connect directly and have like a discovery session or a conversation, particularly if you're looking for, if you're looking to be able to dig into the difficulty of conversations and as we kind of navigate back into the workplace. And it's going to be a challenge, I think, for all of us to kind of negotiate, you know, the changes that have happened over the past couple of years. So I'm happy to have conversation with folks about what that can look like and how I can support them.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Michelle.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Inclusion First podcast. We are always collecting and answering your most important questions on anti-racism. So if there's something on your mind, head on over to the inclusionfirstproject.org and click on Ask a Question. We'd love for you to give us your like, your share, your follow, and especially your review, wherever you find us. Thank you so much again for listening, and we will talk to you next time.